This podcast is supported by The Real Real. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention that everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Welcome back to the Beyond Broadcast podcast, a show which takes a behind-the-scenes look at industry professionals and their lives working in the broadcasting and entertainment industry. Now, today I'm speaking with Kiwi broadcaster Pia Titus. Pia has a journey which is not only eclectic but global. Her career has spanned multiple industries and taken her to various countries, including Japan and Sweden. A jack of many trades, it made sense that she entered the world of media. Now, Pia is the youth coordinator for Christchurch New Zealand public access station, Plains FM. And welcome to the show, Pia.
Thank you so much, Jamie. I'm still surprised to be here. Happy to chat. I feel like a career in broadcasting is a little bit generous, but I do love making radio and podcasts. Currently, I took over from someone else at the station. So while I started at Plains FM as the youth coordinator, I am currently, my role is content and community coordinator. So I work with all the broadcasters, just not the young ones, although plenty of young people as well.
I think that's really beautiful. And I think it kind of made sense that you were always going to go into that sort of area, considering some of the other roles that, and this is kind of the thing that's going to be a bit of a journey with you, Pia, and what the listeners are going to learn about, is that you've had a variety of different roles, which I feel intertwined have created what will eventually be your job and your role now, because you have managed to work with a lot of different people, a lot of different cultures, been in a lot of different scenarios. And I feel like the mutual understanding that you've had to have in some of these roles kind of builds into what you're doing now. And I guess that's probably a good place to start, because up until this point, and because we hadn't actually spoken to each other in person, it's only now that I've realized that you're not actually originally from New Zealand. I made the assumption, born and bred from Christchurch, probably grew up there. And the reason I thought that was one of the first roles that you kind of worked in. But where do your family originally come from? Where were you guys based originally?
My mum's a Kiwi, and my dad's from the States. And this last weekend was their 45th wedding anniversary and their 70th. They both turned 70 last year. So they had a big party, and we've currently got friends and family from Australia and America visiting. So we've just been reliving their glory days. My dad was a draft dodger, from the Vietnam War, wanted to go to Australia, but apparently there were no visas left. So he managed to get one down the hall at the New Zealand office, and ended up hitchhiking around and got picked up by my mum's flatmate's boyfriend, and he brought him home, and they're all still friends, and telling wild tales of their uni days in front of crowds at the Craycroft Stone House. So that's kind of how my family came together. They moved around a bit. My dad was an academic, so we lived in the States, and then when he was doing his postdoc, we lived in Pakistan for a while. We went back to the States after living in New Zealand for a bit, and then in 1995, we moved back to New Zealand permanently. So I did the last year of primary, intermediate, high school in Christchurch. When I was a teenager, I was like, oh, let me get out of this crummy town. I can't wait to never come back. And went to Wellington, where I did my university. And then I traveled and lived overseas for many years and then came back to New Zealand, and then COVID hit and that brought me back to Christchurch. And here I am. I even own a house. So like kind of putting roots down and making myself hopefully useful part of Otatahi's wonderful, diverse community. And it's changed so much since I arrived in 1995 for the better, in my opinion. So it's a beautiful place to be. The city is coming along. It's vibrant. It's beautiful. The rebuild stuff's amazing. I was complaining I was a bit late to this recording because we've got such bad traffic at the moment. They're finishing off the new stadium down the road, which is making getting to work a bit more difficult. But yeah, the city feels exciting. And one of the big reasons for that, I think, is how multinational it's become. A lot of those people coming to Christchurch to help with the rebuild, and a lot of international communities with a lot of pride about what they have contributed to the city. And I think justifiably so, like the Filipino community, definitely a lot of South American communities here. My partner's actually from Brazil. So yeah, a lot of pride in the contributions that people from across the South American continent have made to the rebuild as well. Yeah, so it's a wonderful place to be. Lots of people from Southeast Asia, across the Indian continent, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Nepal. Yeah, it's a multinational, you know, vibrant city now. And it's very different from when I grew up here. Very different.
Because that's the thing. I even noticed it the last time I went back to New Zealand, which would have been about 2 years ago. And yeah, exactly. My memory, and I've said this to another one of my guests that I had very early on, that New Zealand, well, not New Zealand, Christchurch itself did feel very restrictive in terms of the cultures you would encounter, especially when I was growing up, which was, yeah, I was born in 1994, but even in the early 2000s, it was a weird place to be in terms of culturally. It wasn't until like I got out of the city and went to places like Auckland, I was like, wow, like New Zealand is a lot more multicultural in these areas compared to Christchurch. And now, yeah, it seems far more eclectic. Like you described, the Latin American community there is massive now. The idea of having an Argentine restaurant in the central city is like blows my mind, considering I'd be lucky to even find probably a Japanese restaurant in New Zealand in the early 2000s. It's kind of like this weird change, cultural shift, which I think is almost reflective of even how things have turned out for you, because when you started out, you said being a teenager here kind of sucked. And actually going off that, I didn't want to ask the first question, which I know this place because I used to live around the area. You're a store assistant at Day Spa Chocolate. Is that possibly still the weirdest job you've had in your life, working at a chocolate shop? And also, did it make you hate chocolate afterwards? Because I can imagine you would have been completely over it by that point.
It's actually the opposite. Like, I love chocolate. It made me an incredible chocolate snob. And because they didn't really mind if we ate the chocolate, like, you know, like within reason, they're not like have, you know, but they wanted you to know the product and stuff as well. And you can tell how recently something has been made. And it got to the point where like, this is like 4 days old. I don't want to eat that anymore. So yeah, it was the opposite. And now I'm too poor to maintain a fancy chocolate habit. Was it the weirdest job? I don't know. It was a great job. It was a great job. And it was a high school, like I was there in high school and I ended up working all through university in Wellington at the shop in Wellington as well. So yeah. And it is a little bit of a Christchurch institution as well. I think it was established around the same time we came to Christchurch, interestingly, by a Chinese woman and her Belgian husband, and then they employed this Belgian chocolatier who'd worked for the royal family. So it's like this really fancy product that's randomly made in like fairy mead. Yeah. No longer the guy who started the actual chocolatier person, I believe has passed away or is very much retired. But yeah, it's still made by the same recipe and stuff in this tiny little place in fairy mead. But yeah, that's that had a few places, shops around town. I moved around a bit with the earthquake as well. We were in Yeah, lots of different places. There was a bit of a rivalry between the Ballantine's chocolate counter for a while, and they blocked the exit to our shop. Sort of, you know, good, that real good Christchurch.
The Christchurch dynasty of chocolatiers. Yeah, yeah, you're going to watch that one. It's a vicious drama. There could be a Netflix series about it.
yeah, absolutely. But yeah, other jobs I had... that was probably my main one in Christchurch before I came back. But I guess other interesting jobs I've had. When my first job, I started as an intern at Family Planning while I was at university. I did my placement there for an internship. And then a job came available as a researcher and librarian there. And I got the job. So my first job was working in a sexual health library. I don't know that I was very good at it. I was working by myself and really had no idea what I was doing, but they seemed to like me enough because I did a little, tried to do my OE in London, and I was there with my partner at the time, and she didn't really like London. So we came back, and then I knocked on their door. I was like, I'm back. And they're like, oh, we have a job open. And so then I became a sexual health educator. So I worked with schools and teachers. I created curriculum and education packages. I worked in child, youth, and family houses for kids who could no longer be at home, in places where if kids were coming out of juvenile detention centers, they would go and live in these places. So I would work with them. I'd work with kids who were no longer able to be in traditional education. In Wellington, I don't know if it's the same everywhere. I haven't kind of seen the same stuff in Christchurch, but it's called the academy system, much smaller classes. Often the kids get taught life skills like cooking and looking after themselves financially and stuff like that as well. So we would go in and be part of that education. That was a pretty wild job. Had some pretty strange experiences there. Then I went to Japan on the JET program.
Based on family planning, can I go back to that? Because it seems like you're brushing over so much in that little area, because that's quite a serious role to be working in. Obviously, for anyone who doesn't know, family planning, as you said, has many facets in terms of where you can really go with that, including obviously education with kids and, like you said, working with child services, among other things. Do you think, because you said as well that you started by making some of the curriculum, is that kind of where you first started dipping into creating content? Because essentially you studied English Lit, you did English language, you had a good understanding of, I guess, writing things that were interesting or made people want to read it. Is that kind of where you first started kind of developing this sort of skill or really starting to use it?
Yeah, I guess that job really was about communication and pitching stuff at the right level for your audience, right? You're not, so family planning, I guess if there's international people, that would be the same as Planned Parenthood in the States. So we're dealing with sexual health, reproduction, contraception, a lot to do with healthy relationships. We would have stuff for parents. We'd have education nights for parents, and we'd have resources for them to do sexual health stuff in a positive way with their kids, so they don't get just some sort of scared secondhand information that isn't accurate anymore. Mm. So, yeah, it's really about pitching information at the right audience. And I learned a lot. The person who really took that education at family planning to the next level, her name was Dr. Frances Bird. She was amazing. She was just amazing. She was a wonderful person to work for. I actually still know the chief executive, Jackie Edmond, of Family Planning. In New Zealand, they've just rebranded as, I believe it's Positive Sexual Health. So those two women were the ones who kind of really drove at a higher level what we were doing. And then we would work with the New Zealand health curriculum and create resources pitched at the right audience. And the idea with what I was doing there was to introduce and destigmatize bodies, technical terms, there's very good research that shows that if young people and children in particular can name their body parts accurately, they're more likely to report any sort of off sexual behavior, including sexual abuse. So things like we would play games, you know, where we would toss a ball and people had to say all the words, you know.
Controlling kids must have been interesting in its own right, because learning all these words, they're younger. Is it almost in a way you're trying to take away like the funny side of it as well? Because I'm guessing they're like, oh, penis. So it's almost trying to find a way to like destigmatize the words, make it normal to use a normal language and not make it feel like it's this juvenile thing that you're saying.
Yeah, well, you have to get all as well. Yeah, absolutely. And you have to get all the funny stuff out first. So one of the ways we would start, and this again depends on the age, we would have like pieces of paper and they had to write every single word they could think of. And, you know, that would really get out all of the silly ones. And, you know, you always inevitably learned some words you'd never heard before. And then from there, you would kind of move into, these are the technical terms that work.
This podcast is supported by The Real Real. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something you're impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention that everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
I'm going to use, making those more commonplace and actually just getting people literally comfortable in saying them. For certain minority communities, there's a huge stigma against even saying those words out loud. Like I was at one school and even one of the teachers was like, and she was from an ethnic minority background. And she's like, well, I can't say these words. And actually her discomfort level was so high. Trying to make it comfortable for everyone. That's important when you're trying to learn and talk about stuff, that the people who are delivering the material are comfortable as well, because kids in particular, I think, really can understand a lot from the tone of voice or, you know, the vibe or energy that's coming off someone. So, yeah, making it fun. But making it controlled and safe as well.
Because as you that's the other thing, I wouldn't have even considered the fact that some teachers themselves would have felt uncomfortable with the topics at hand. So you do have this kind of, you have to make it as successful as possible, but also have to play with the fact that there might be other factors at play. Like, I'm sure the biggest concern would have been, oh, will the kids take this seriously? Will they acknowledge it? But I wouldn't have even considered the fact that the teachers would be partial to that as well and maybe might have an influence in how the kids can learn. And funnily enough, I do actually remember that exact exercise that you're talking about, and I remember doing it when I was 9 years old. I specifically remember doing that exact exercise of listing all the names.
Yeah. Parents can play a huge impact. I remember particularly one night, often we would do parent workshops and stuff before we went into schools. And, you know, their parents being like, my kids don't even know the words, or, you know, oh, this is, and like that parent's kid was a little sexual deviant who was, I mean, that's a bit harsh, but, you know, he was putting the rude stuff into the box and like holding hands with girls under the table when he was sort of like 10 or 11. You know, her idea of what her son's reality was and what we saw in the classroom were very, very different.
But yeah, it must have been really interesting for you creating that curriculum, obviously working with the children and getting to have a better understanding of that, because it kind of works with you being able to understand different cultures in a later point of your life. And in that respect, I should probably switch gears to talking about the kind of next stage of your life, because you did all this fantastic work in Wellington, but then not long after you ended up moving to Japan. So it seemed like you were constantly on the move. So what influenced you to then make this big move to get involved with teaching English in Japan as part of the JET program and moving over there? Because that's quite a big cultural shift and also quite a big change in terms of what you were doing.
Yeah, believe it or not, but there is actually so much you can say about sex, and then you've said it all. was getting a little bit bored at family planning, and I really wanted to live overseas. And funnily enough, everyone in my family has done the JET program at one stage or another. All of my cousins have done it. My sister's done it. And so I knew I was going to do it as well. I ended up in the beautiful little town of Sonobe, which is about 45 minutes outside of Kyoto. And the only thing that's famous about Sonobe is the creator of Mario Brothers grew up there. And actually, Zelda's cave is there. And once you're in the town, you kind of look around at the little hills that you would see in the back of Mario, and you're like, oh yeah, I can sort of see where this is. But a very tiny little town, very sleepy, one high school, little primary school. And it was an interesting school. It had an international focus. It had an international stream. And the kids would spend a lot of time looking at other countries, which if you've spent time and lived and worked in Japan, is not common. It's not like us in New Zealand where we have multiculturalism. There's lots of different people. Japan is a monoculture. Even people who are third generation Koreans, who I wouldn't be able to tell from visually or by speaking to them in any way that they were not ethnically Japanese, still would identify as Korean or not ethnically Japanese. So very different from how we experience cultures here in New Zealand. And so what I would do was help them prepare for a lot of international travel. So the international classes would go to, they would spend time in Singapore, Malaysia, Australia, and a couple of them, I think one of them went to Edinburgh as well for another exchange. So I would help them prepare for that. They had to have quite high level English speaking abilities to sort of thrive in these places. And they would be doing a lot of testing for English. So there was also an English club that I ran, which was pretty hilarious. Like, I sometimes still think about it. I'm like, was that helpful to them? I don't know. We had a kid who, I was thinking about him the other day, actually, I would say was definitely a bit on the spectrum. He really liked numbers. And so I taught him how to play poker. And I basically started this English language poker ring. We would use Monopoly money. And I found like those green visors, you know, that they would have for, you know, counting money. And so we would wear our green visors, play poker in English, and then like if they won, I would make them say things like winner winner chicken dinner. And I'm like, have I created a generation of gamblers in this small Japanese town? But it really worked for this one kid in particular, and because it worked for him, it worked for everyone. So we played lots of games, and yeah, living in Japan was really wonderful. I was there for 2 years. I think I may have stayed longer, but my partner at the time wanted to come home. She was much more career oriented than I was. And now she's, came home and has been very successful in doing so. So definitely the right move for her. But Japan was, I would say, being a foreigner in Japan is a wonderful, wonderful experience. You have slightly different expectations at work. So my experience of working there, I didn't have the pressure that a lot of the teachers, the real, quote unquote, real teachers had. I got to really enjoy the culture as well. I got really into kimono. So I learned how to put on a kimono myself. I collected a lot of vintage kimonos. That was my fun little Japanese hobby. I spent a lot of time at flea markets. And for people listening who don't know, most people can't put on a kimono in Japan. You go to a salon and someone would put it on for you. So to know how to do it for yourself is sort of a lost art now. But I had someone teach me how to do it. And so I have all my stuff here still, tea ceremony stuff. I joined the school's Ikebana club. I still do little Ikebana projects at home, my little funny vases and stuff that I brought home. So yeah, I had a wonderful time in Japan. Again, communication was really important. Learning to pitch your communication at whoever you're talking to. And I do find that having spent that time in Japan was absolutely invaluable as a human, understanding what it is to be an immigrant. And I try and explain this to people, like, as an immigrant in Japan, I was at the top of the heap, right? I was a white lady, so I'm not threatening in the way that a man is. I'm the preferred foreign ethnicity. I'm visibly foreign, so people know what to expect when they talk to me. But it was still very difficult. And I am a bit dyslexic. I didn't find learning the language particularly easy. So I really got by on very little Japanese, and I grew up in the States in Southern California, fairly close to the Mexican border, and I remember having kids whose parents, or particularly mothers, never really learned English, and their kids did a lot of translating for them, and even as a child thinking, oh, I wish I could talk to her, or why doesn't she learn English? And my goodness, totally understand now. It was absolutely possible to get by without really speaking the language, and just how you learn to navigate, communicate non-verbally. You learn certain words. Like, I could read katakana. I knew a little bit of kanji. I just learned the ones I really needed to get by. Like, I could get home in a taxi. I could order food. So yeah, you kind of just learn to adapt. And I feel like that's put me in great stead as just a human in the world, understanding other migrants and minorities. When I got back, I was a little bit too enthusiastic, and anyone who looked vaguely foreign and lost, I would go up to them and be like, oh, can I help you? I understand your struggles. I think I've chilled out a bit, but that's really helped a lot in this job that I do now. We work with people whose English is not their first language. They might be new to New Zealand. They don't really understand, like, customs. I had a situation recently where someone got a parking ticket because they didn't understand that you paid for parking when you entered the car park, because in their home country, they paid when they left. So, you know, being able to sort of help explain stuff and being like, oh, yeah, of course, I know, like, when I've been overseas, like, just little things like that, being able to kind of help people navigate some of that stuff.
It's really interesting. You touched on a lot of the same feelings I have. And we were discussing this before, Pierre, that I'm based in Argentina. I'm very much the same experience as you. And admittedly, I did take high school Spanish before I came here, but I was terrible. Like, the fact I couldn't even order a cab here. The weirdest thing I can think of is the fact that when you're trying to describe where you need to go, you don't tell people the exact address. You say, what are the adjacent streets? So me trying to explain it to a taxi before I even got in, and I'm just almost like crying, being like, I just want to go home. Like, please take me home. I have no idea where I'm going. And so, yeah, I completely get it. It's a really good cultural learning, going to another country where you don't totally speak the language. And then on top of that, obviously trying to understand the intricacies of maybe different cultures, especially, like you said, Japan, monocultural. Most of the times, they might not have met someone from a different country before, especially like you said, in these smaller villages that might have only one high school. The likelihood that they've probably met someone from the US, let alone New Zealand, is probably zilch to none. And then you're having to go in there and be like, trust me, guys, I want to talk to you. I want to become your friend. It can be hard. But you did say as well, I can completely agree. And I definitely can attest to this as well. We do have and it's not bad in saying it, an advantage. Like, I know people are far more helpful to me because they're like, oh, you're clearly not, and as weird as it sounds, because I'm not American and they know I'm not American, people are actually more helpful to me. And obviously because I'm a man and look non-threatening, they're like, oh, we'll help you with anything you need. Even if my Spanish is terrible, they'll still come out and help me. And it's kind of a really bizarre thing. But then on top of that, it does, if you're a foreigner in a country, and especially like you said, an immigrant, which is essentially what we were, you do have to learn how to communicate with people in ways that maybe you wouldn't have expected, like maybe aggressively pointing at something or kind of trying to think of how you can mouth it. So I think it's beautiful that you managed to translate that same difficulty that you had in Japan to then be able to transfer that to the job you have now. Because, I should probably mention as well that I used to work at Plains FM just like Pia, not in that role, but you would meet a variety of different groups. And do you think even now you're still getting surprised every day by maybe different cultures that you're meeting or different experiences you're having with people that you encounter on the daily basis?
Yeah, I think it's another one of those jobs, like it is weird and wonderful. You never know what's going to happen in a day. So I guess, shall I explain a little bit about what Plains FM is for listeners? Because it's not your typical radio station.
I think that would be a good move. Delving into what even public radio is in New Zealand is probably helpful because, as much as I probably can give a good description, I'm sure you can give a better one, Pierre.
So New Zealand has lots of different types of radio. I'm going to give you my, I do school group tours. I've just been working with the broadcasting school recently. So here's the pitch that I give to everyone. So New Zealand has lots of different types of radio. We have commercial radio. We actually have the largest number of commercial frequencies per capita in the world. Radio is a big part of our media landscape. And for a long time, it was the most profitable part of the New Zealand media landscape. I used to work at The Breeze, which was part of a network called MediaWorks, and that network also owned a TV station. And for a long time, the radio stations financially supported that TV station. So radio is very profitable and diverse in New Zealand. A lot of the commercial stations skew very specifically to different populations, which is a little bit different from some radio in other countries. We also have a national broadcaster called Radio New Zealand. The idea of this broadcaster is that all New Zealanders can be reflected back by this station. It's got very good current affairs and news. It has a lot of magazine-style programming where they're interviewing people who are creating music or art or science. They have really great Pacifica reporting across the Pacific region. And so that's generally for all New Zealanders. We also have iwi radio. This is set up to make sure that our local tribes, the Māori tribes in New Zealand, each have a radio station, and that's to broadcast local news in te reo. So it's tribal news, it's hyper-local. It's for people who may already have some te reo language. It doesn't necessarily always broadcast in te reo, but it does have quite a bit in their broadcasting frequency. And then we have Access Media. So Access Media, Community Access Media, it's almost like the opposite of Radio New Zealand. Rather than trying to reflect back the general New Zealand population, we're here for minorities. So it's not about having the biggest audience. We're here for people to kind of find and connect with their communities. So we broadcast in over 20 languages at the moment. And people come to us, we train them in how to create content, and that can be technical training and training around how to actually think about the things they're going to talk about, connect with their audience, and then we kind of let them loose with some caveats. So my job really is around training. And part of that training, I should say, is the broadcasting standards, because there are legal requirements that people have to follow. And then from there, they kind of network into their own communities. There is a piece of legislation that kind of creates the provision for community access radio in New Zealand. It's called Section 36C of the Broadcasting Act, and it specifically lists groups that we are here to sort of service or serve, and that those are children and youth, women, people of ethnic or cultural minorities, and that can include linguistically diverse communities. Also people who come from different philosophical or spiritual backgrounds. So we have programming from the Socialist Society, from local churches, from other spiritual organizations and individuals. and also people with disabilities. So we have a range of programming created by people with disabilities. We have one at the moment that kind of is standing out is a young man called Luca with Down syndrome, and he's also a very successful swimmer. So we actually had Attitude TV, which is a show that highlights people with disabilities who are doing amazing things. They were here filming with us last week for Luca. So he does a radio show and he talks about his life, plays music. He loves Jason Derulo, so he features heavily in his show. The key for what we do and we say is by, for, and about. So the media is created by that community, for that community, about that community. And if you think about it, that's very different when you have, say, a news organization coming in from the outside, taking a story, repackaging it for an audience that is not part of that community, and broadcasting it externally from that community. So when it's content created by that community, for that community, about that community, you do get quite a different type of content. And that's what we do. So yeah, big part of my job is training, connecting with communities. Excitingly, we've just had the Somali community come on board. They've just finished their first show. It's Eid at the moment, Ramadan at the moment. So they're going to be taking some recording devices and going and recording at one of their iftars. So yeah, it's really exciting sort of stuff that we do. I always kind of forget, you know, Christchurch is not a huge place, you know, 500,000 people or whatever. And we've got like a radio station that, you know, is doing amazing stuff, putting out a huge amount of content for very diverse populations. So yeah, I think we do a really incredible job. There's 5 people here. We work really hard. Some days are pretty crazy. And it's one of those, you know, it's a community organization, so it's not like we're rolling in money. We kind of have to do everything. If there's a technical issue, that has to be problem solved. If there's, you know, a people issue, we all have to come on board and sort of work that out as well.
And it's a bit of education in every sense, because a lot of the groups that you'll be working with have different, much like what you said, caveats, maybe from a cultural religion and everything else. For a lot of the people that are coming in for training, you probably help a little bit in terms of kind of directing them on how they should create content, in the sense of being like, hey, how about this? Like, have you guys thought about creating a show around this sort of idea? Do you think in that sense that the role is quite creative, because you might be working with the Somali community who might not know what we want to talk about roughly, or what should kind of be the topic that we try to aim for? And then you kind of say, guys, have you thought about this? This is a really interesting topic. Like you said, like Eid is on at the moment. They probably didn't, maybe someone didn't think, oh, we should talk about Eid. People probably don't know about Eid. What should we talk about? Do you feel like that's kind of given you a lot to play with in terms of working at Plains?
Yeah, I think one of the hard things about my job is I have so many ideas and so little time. So it really is about, like I said, there's 5 people who work here. We just physically can't create that much stuff. So it really has to become other people come to us and create the content. In terms of education, you get such a huge variety of people coming through the door. Some people who have very specific ideas, and it's hard to move them on from those. And I think people find more or less success if they're rigid in their thinking. One of the things I think we struggle with a bit at the moment is kind of podcasting's a little bit cool and trendy, and so people think they're going to be the next Joe Rogan. That's quite hard. You know, like, this is Christchurch, New Zealand. You're not going to be having huge audiences. People coming in thinking they're going to financially benefit from doing a show with us. That's not really going to happen unless something magical occurs. Or you're kind of using the podcast in conjunction with other things, or your radio show in conjunction with other things. And podcasting in general, like for us, is quite an interesting one. We are a radio station first. We are funded to be a radio station. So podcasting is kind of secondary to what we do. We have an audience. We know people are listening to us. You can't measure audiences through an FM frequency. So we can't tell people exactly how many listeners they have at any one time. Podcasting does allow us to sort of measure listeners a little bit. But how people engage with podcasts versus the radio is quite different. So we have this very delicate sort of ecosystem that we're balancing at the moment, in terms of what people want and how they connect with others. I would say we've had a sort of uptick in people wanting to do maybe shorter series. I think people really underestimate the amount of effort and energy and time it takes to create a podcast. So what I tell people when they come through the door is like, you need to especially when you're starting. So, you know, if you're going to do a half hour podcast, you need to account for at least five times that amount of time. And this is for an amateur person. You need to account for at least five times. So you have to think about how to get a guest. Most people don't understand that that's the hardest part of podcasting. It's actually getting your calendar to line up. A huge amount of your time goes into scheduling. And Jamie and I are a great example of this. We're in different time zones. I'm busy. Yeah. He's busy. I had to cancel the last recording because something came up at the station. So a huge amount of your time, I would say most of your time, actually goes into calendar and guest management. And you need to account for that. The next is you have to work backwards. So if you have a topic for your podcast, you actually need to think about the questions you want to ask your guest so that they'll give you the answers that you're looking for. You need to think about who it is you're trying to reach, because if you're trying to reach a certain audience, you need to package that content in a way that they want to hear it, or else you may as well not be here. So if you're working with young people, you need to think about the language that you use or the type of music that you have, what topics you actually cover. Is this actually interesting to a young person? I'm talking with someone at the moment about, she's from an organization that works with like disarmament stuff, and she wants to make a podcast. I'm like, well, who is this for? Because you could make this in, you know, 40 different ways for 40 different audiences, but you can't probably reach all of those audiences. So you actually need to make some decisions about who it is you want to reach. And that will inform the type of content you want to make. Then you have to think about actually writing the questions and doing some research. You've been amazing, Jamie, at going through my Facebook page, I assume, to find all of this information. That takes time too. You'll also then need to write the questions. You had a lovely introduction at the beginning that was scripted. I always recommend people do a scripted introduction. That takes time. So that's just the prep. You physically have to get to the station because a lot of people are coming in and recording here. That, you know, you need to allow probably 45 minutes because of the traffic at the moment. It's really hard to find parking. So now you're at the station. You've probably already spent a couple hours getting your guest organized, getting prepped. Now you need to sit down with them, have a cup of tea before the show. You physically get them into the studio or up on Zoom. You do the interview. Now you have to write your podcast description that gets uploaded with it. And if you actually want people to find it, you need to post something on social media. I think people often underestimate the amount of time that social media, good social media, takes to do. Finding the right tags to tag people in, scheduling it, getting a decent photo. All of that takes time. So, you know, for a half hour podcast, it isn't half an hour. It's, you know, 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours, depending on the level of quality you want to do. And because we're a radio station, we really rely on people to create content regularly. So ideally for us, people would create weekly content. But as you can see, that half hour show is not really half an hour. So you're asking people to commit quite a bit of time to a show. So a real delicate balance for us is asking people to create content in a sustainable way. And that can be really hard to navigate because, like I said, sometimes people have quite grandiose ideas when they come in through the door. One of the things that brought me personally into podcasting was I loved This American Life. And I was a very early podcast adopter. I remember the first episode of like 99% Invisible coming out, or the first episode of Planet Money coming out. Like I was already deeply engaged in that type of content. That is, you're looking at weeks to create that half hour of content. And people sometimes will come to us and they're like, I want to do a storytelling podcast and I want it to sound like this and this. I'm like, I'm sorry, we can't do that. And quite frankly, you will never be able to do that if you're going to work full time.
Like, yes.
That's a hard conversation to have with people. What I would say is, like, you can go and create anything you want from the comfort of your own bedroom. But if you're, what we offer you as a station is we will take you, we're not going to be at like Radio New Zealand level, but we will be pretty darn close, and we're going to take a lot of that work out for you. But we just will never be able to be making those sort of audio documentary, narrative journalism style pieces. That can be a hard conversation to have with people. We also, one interesting thing that I've sort of seen a little bit of an uptick in is people wanting to have like controversial topics or controversial conversations. Plains FM is one of the last places I know of, and maybe I should say this for all the access stations, the expectation when people walk through the door is that everyone is safe and everyone is welcome. So we have communities who are broadcasting here that are in direct conflict outside of the station. But everyone knows that on Plains FM, the content is positive. We could talk about hard things, but we do so in a way that's respectful and kind. We don't disparage other communities. Or other organizational groups. That takes everyone coming on board and being respectful in that way. So
Could I address that? Because I think what's interesting is I definitely know there's been programming, and I'm not saying they're controversial at all, because they're not. If anything, they're the loveliest people. And I remember working the team behind Earthwise, which is a show that's been running for a number of years. And I can imagine some of the topics that, and still going, which is amazing. I don't even know how old they are now, probably in their early 70s. But I know 80s. They've always covered 80s. Wow. And incredible hosts, by the way.
I think they're pushing 80. Yeah.
Wow. Oh, my God. And that's what I mean.
Well, maybe not. Maybe I'm aging them to make them sound more impressive.
I hope not. But no, I'm joking. But yeah, they cover some pretty controversial topics in the sense of like what they're covering can be quite intense. But at no point have I ever felt like it was confrontational directly to the people. As you said, it's almost like a, what do you call it? Like a no man's land. No, like Plains FM is peaceful. It's fine. People can address their topics, but not in a way that's confrontational or offensive. And I think maybe that's where the accessibility comes from, and maybe why it's called Access Radio, that it's always accessible. People can share the views as long as it's not something that is in any way violent towards someone else, which I think has always been a beautiful thing. And is that something that's kind of made you have a newfound respect for Access Radio as well? Because the longer you're there, the more you realize like how important that is to be in the, like, to have that space in the media industry.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, every job is hard, and this job is relentless. You know, it is just relentless. And if something goes wrong, you need to jump in and problem solve, which, you know, that can be really hard as well. I think, and I do have moments of, like, just true awe at what we do. Like, we really nurture this just precious little place left in the world where people are kind. Like, you know, in the world of social media, that does not exist. Plains FM is kind. It is positive. It's nurturing. In some ways, I don't even know if the audience, like, who gets the most out of it. I think in some ways, what the gift that we give is to the broadcasters. And I've seen people, like, I have someone coming in today who came from an incredibly unstable background, a child of parents who had mental health, drug addiction, like every bad thing that could happen to someone has happened to this person. And she has been able to have a show on Plains FM, talk to other people in a similar situation, find healing, clarity, share her own experience, in a way that I just think, like, you know, she came in with no skills and stuff like that. We've been able to teach her audio editing. That's a real marketable skill, you know? And she's been able to do an incredible job of interviewing people. It's not always the people I would interview. People say things that I don't agree with. But she is able to connect and work with in, you know, communities that are marginalized in a way that I could never do that. So the benefit to her, I think, you know, we may never know how deeply she's benefited from this. And those communities have been able to come and have a space here as well. One of the communities that I think we do the we've just done amazing stuff for, well, they do it for themselves, really. We create the platform. It's the Alcoholics Anonymous radio show here in Christchurch. They managed to get their show on an American app. And so they get tens of thousands of hits a month from all over the world. And I've had people calling me in tears. Like, I picked up the station phone that plays at 5 p.m. on a Monday. I was working late. And I had someone, she's like, oh my God, I needed to hear this today. Thank you so much for playing this. You know, like, we just don't understand, especially in a busy day where people are pissing you off. Everyone's a special snowflake here a little bit. Everyone's got a personality. You don't get into community media because you're like, you know, like, it takes
hard as
a
nails,
certain type
yeah,
of,
and your cutthroat yeah, and everything type else. Of you're person. All quite like, yeah.
So the people here who come here can be a bit needy. It's like, oh, by the end of the day, you're just like, oh my goodness. But then you have stuff like that happens, and it's like, wow, we actually are really doing something truly incredible here. And then on the flip side of that, I've had people come into the station, want to start a show, and I'm like, well, this, you know, I want to be like trigonometry, and I want to take down the socialists. I'm like, oh, that's not really what we do here. And like, I got into a screaming fight with somebody. He's like, do you just want nice community media? I was like, yes.
Ideally, so, like, yeah, that's the plan.
Yeah, like, you can go and yell on the internet, but we don't need that here. There's plenty of that in the world. And I feel like quite protective of Plains FM and the broadcasters. And like I said, it's a hard job. It's easy to burn out on. I've had moments of burnout. People will take as much as you can give. And I am a little bit of a giver in terms of my time and energy. And that's got me into a lot of trouble. So actually learning to balance stuff, I don't know that I've done that successfully so far. Another problem that I find is I like to say yes to people, and then I find out that their needs are higher than that I can actually accommodate for. And that can be really hard as well, because part of what I do is, like, I can help you set up your show, but I can't help run it. So, like, once you get established, you need to be on your own. You need to be self-sufficient. But yeah, so that can be a bit of a point of conflict as well. People who kind of need ongoing support, and we just have to sort of say, look, we can't help you beyond this point. And it's simply because, like I keep saying, there's five people who run the station. You know, we just
and to go back
we have
on
a
that
very
as well,
fine
Pierre.
Out.
Because you worked in commercial radio, you understand the radio landscape in general and what it's like. I have too. I've worked in commercial radio, and it's a completely different beast of community. Like, I felt like Plains was my safe space when I was working there. I was like, this is awesome. Like, the people are lovely. And then when you go to commercial, you kind of realize as well, like, oh, there's so many more people here that do stuff. Like, you can kind of, like, there's a little bit more delegation. So, yeah, as you said, it's very easy to get burnt out. And I'll be totally straight as well. I got quite burnt out when I was working there for exactly the same reason. I said yes to a lot of people. I was like, oh, I'll edit your three-hour recording that you've just taken at some festival. And then realizing, oh, God, like, it's 9 o'clock at night on a Friday. I should be at home right now. Why am I still doing this? Yeah, it's hard because you want to be there
and I get
for these people. Yeah.
I get really, and I think back to my job where my job was literally, I was managing social media, I was getting interviews recorded, I was setting up events, but for one show, I work with, like, I don't even know how many shows, I think we have 120 shows on Plains FM. You just cannot give people the amount of time and care you would. I mean, it's not a commercial show. And that can be really hard at times, because we do have a few shows where I'm like, this has got, you know, like, under the right circumstances with enough money, like this could be huge. We have a show, one that always sticks out to me is Bookends. You'll remember Morn and Ruth. Ruth has retired and we have someone new who's come on board. Ruth, I should say to people listening, has been a broadcaster since like 1992. She was 94 when she retired, I think. Like, she was incredible. Could she write a social media post? No. So they've got someone new involved. They're getting stuff on social media. It was a book review show. And these two women had talked to like every New Zealand author. I mean, everyone, like literally everyone, about every book. Like, they had done the most incredible job. I think we've got like 500 or 600 episodes, maybe more, like huge number of episodes. But because we don't have the capacity to like kind of get it out, like it just doesn't have the listenership it deserves. And that can be quite hard at times. Like, you see the potential of stuff, but you know, they're the same as everyone else. They get the same amount of time in the studio as everyone else. You know, that's can be a bit of a hard part of the job as well. And it is amazing to see people who do flourish. We have someone who works at the station now. He started as a teenager. I think he was 15. He did a Latin, Spanish language Latin show, and he stuck around long enough that we kind of gave him a job, and he went and did journalism. I mean, he's been up at the Chilean embassy for like stuff. He's been invited to all of these events. He's won awards. Like, he's really taken it in quite far. In lockdown, they were getting several thousand hits for each show, because they were doing live streams and from around the world. Like, they had this random like community in like Southern California. I mean, it's weird what people will tune into.
I think that was, yeah. And you hit the nail on the head. I do remember Bookends. I used to work with Ruth quite early on and absolutely loved her. She was an absolute legend of the craft. And I specifically remember one interview she did with an author called Paul Cleave, who now is actually extremely popular, but Ruth found him when he was literally writing like novels that no one was reading, and she managed to find this guy that's now an award-winning author, has a TV show that's been released, and it's like, how do these guys have the resources to fund it? And I think that's, as you said, that's what's always amazing, and sometimes you find these diamonds in the rough, and it's not even in the rough because Plains has put out some great stuff, but it's like, how can these people that it's not their day job, they're just putting some time in themselves to kind of create some content, and they make such an incredible show just from like literally nothing. And I think that's what's always great about Plains, is you guys provide the facility for people to be able to discover that they can do this, even with like very little resource, which is awesome. And Pia, I probably should let you go because I know you are just starting work for the day. It's 9 a.m. where you are. And I just want to say, I'd love to have you back on at some point, because I think there's probably so much more we can still talk about, especially regarding public access radio in New Zealand and just the industry itself. But one final question I wanted to ask you is, where do you see the public access media scene going now? I know that New Zealand On Air funding has been cut in a lot of areas. I know public broadcasting and broadcasting in general is an area that the government is like, and obviously, if it's something you don't want to touch on, that's totally fine. But I'd be curious to see what do you think is your prediction for maybe the next like couple of years for public broadcasting, public access media, or for people getting involved in public access as well?
Look, it's really hard to say. The Broadcasting Act of 1989 is up for review under the current government. We've been part of the submission process. They do not mention Section 36C, that section I mentioned earlier, that has the provisions for minority groups. That is not part of the current revision. We don't know if it's going to be in the next phase of the act. We really don't know. One thing I think that's in our favor is that the management of all of the stations, there's 12 stations around New Zealand, got together and created something called KAMA. So this is where they've all put a little bit of their budget together. They've paid for someone to advocate on behalf of the sector. The person who's doing it is a journalist and she has a law degree. She's been really active. And I think Nikki, the station manager, deserves a lot of credit at Plains FM for where we're at now. At the end of this week, we're actually rebranding the station. So when this comes out, we'll be under a different name. It will be called Plains Media. And that's to reflect the fact that we do a lot of podcasting. We have a lot of online content. Currently, we have quite a few culturally and linguistically called communities, diverse communities wanting streaming. So we are looking at potentially getting the on-air studio set up for live streaming with video content. That's something we've seen across audio first content, is this move towards having a video element as well. Ultimately, I believe our responsibility lies to our broadcasters and their community. So if this is something that they're calling for, I think it's important that we take that seriously and look into it. Where that funding comes from and the time frame in which that's going to happen, we don't know. How we survive beyond funding cuts, I don't know. So actually how we move forward, I really don't know. I mean, it is an interesting time. One of the things that's in our favor is that we're really cheap to run. You know, the station, when you look at how much it costs to run Plains FM, it is like cheap by the standards of any public funding. So I guess that's beneficial. I do think the foresight of people like our station manager, Nikki, and other station managers in creating that body, they did some amazing work last year where we created like a snapshot of like what we do in a day, and we had to record like exactly what we did in a day. It's like incredibly diverse. So it's just like what you get for your funding dollar is pretty incredible. So I remain hopeful that we continue, but it'll be an interesting couple of years. I think the state of the world at the moment, we really don't know. We really don't know economically how stuff's going to go, where our government's at. We currently in New Zealand have a right-leaning government that it has cut a lot of public stuff. So for them to be reviewing the Broadcasting Act, I think it's a great opportunity. What they will focus on with funding and stuff, we really don't know. We've met with the minister, one of the under ministers for radio. She was very positive. She came from a radio background. Again, what that actually means when it comes to the whole Broadcasting Act, we really don't know. But we can only remain hopeful.
If you like the podcast, I'd love for you to leave a 5-star review on your preferred podcast platform and let me know your thoughts on the show. Don't forget, you can reach out to me via Instagram at beyondbroadcastpod or via email at beyondbroadcastpod@gmail.com. Until next time, take it easy.